on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
You know, you kind of always walk away from situations and you think, gosh, I wish I'd done that, or I wish I'd said this epic comeback and just shut the whole thing down, and you never do unless you should cry or something. So in the book, I got to make my heroine do all the stuff that I was too afraid to do. And so it was really cool.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers, no more barriers, no one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome. Yes, it is The Self-Publishing Show on a Friday with me, James Blatch.
And me, Mark Dawson.
Difference in energy levels there, Mark.
Huh? What? Who? Energy?
Quite a different... Yes. Are you with us?
Thanks, Alan. Yes, I'm just very busy today. Loads and loads of things going on. Running around like a blue-assed you-know-what.
Yes.
To get things done.
I do, indeed. It's the first of the month, and I do lots of bill paying and accounts and stuff on the first, and it is spreadsheet-tastic, but I just mentioned to you, and you've pointed out to me that it is in the community several times, so I didn't notice it, that there's a set of spurious extra payments arrived from KDP.
Not spurious.
Into our bank account. Not spurious. Well, on the face of it, spurious.
Mysterious,
because they are marked as December royalties, which wouldn't be due until the end of this month, beginning of next month. And in our case, they've actually been split between us, Fuse, and the authors, Terry and Maureen, who are Robert's story's parents. And I'm guessing it's because whatever this covers, whatever historical adjustments happening here or wider distribution money's eventually filtered through or whatever it is, it actually predates February 2020, which is when they had the books in their account, which is interesting. So I don't know. I haven't properly scrutinized the historic data reports, but there might be buried somewhere in there what this is. It should be. It should be accounted for somewhere.
In theory, yes. No, I think it's just I think it's an annual adjustment. I don't think I've seen it before, although it's possible I have. But yeah, it's just I think Amazon must have done some kind of audit and realized that people have been underpaid. That would be my guess. Also, there was an email that went around about KU page reads not being calculated properly. So could be that. I don't know exactly. I haven't looked. It was a few thousand for me. It was quite a pleasant little... Well, not that little, about five figures, I think, in terms of adjustments. So a nice little bonus. Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, couple of thousand. Thank you, Jeff, for Fuse Books. And I try to keep in touch with other people through the community. I know there's been a bit of stuff about Facebook ads. We might just mention that one actually in a moment. But we're doing well. Fuse is doing well. Month on month, stronger and stronger. Had our first five-figure income month for January, and our biggest profitable month as well. Hopefully it's not just the pandemic and lockdown, but it is just a growth. Or maybe it's a result of those people who joined Kindle Unlimited last summer are now regularly reading. That'd be a nice thing for the next few years.
Yeah, it'll be a number of different reasons. But also, the books have been advertised properly, which hasn't happened for a long time, if ever, properly. And that's so you're seeing read through, and you're seeing all the things we talk about on this podcast and in courses and things. It's just that's what's supposed to happen. So you're doing well.
I will add a session. I'm not going to promise it in the next few days, but in the next few weeks, I will add a session to our Facebook Ads for Authors course on dynamic creative, because the impact of spending half a day breaking down those individual elements, looking at the historical data and then crossing out the bottom ones and moving some over different territories that work better. The impact on my profitability has been significant, having spent that half a day about 3 weeks ago. It's been really interesting. So definitely, it's slightly laborious at the beginning, but if you break it down and you have a nice spreadsheet to help you, it's definitely something that authors should do. If you create dynamic creatives,
do you break it down like MC Hammer?
I break it exactly like that. Well, you know how I am. So I basically live my life in a big pair of trousers.
That's very true.
And we should say, for those who aren't doing it, dynamic creative is where instead of having one image, one headline, one description, you have multiple versions of those. And Facebook itself decides based on response which ones it's going to serve. But you can then look, the genius thing is, a few weeks, month later, you can see the data of which ones have performed best, which ones have led to clicks that have led to sales. Well, if you can track sales to that level. One other thing which has popped up a few times, like three or four people now have started their own thread on this in our Facebook groups, is that when you're looking at your advert via your page in Business Manager and you click on your advert, you get this rather ugly box pops up saying you're about to leave Facebook and go to this horrible looking URL, which is basically your Amazon URL turned into some kind of tracking URL, which would be horrific if we thought our end users, Facebook users, were actually seeing that when they clicked on your ad. But as far as we can tell, Mark, this is something we are seeing when we click on our own ad via our page. It's not being experienced by readers.
Yeah, I've never had any complaints about it. And I've never actually seen that myself. But it does look like that is what happens when you click on your own link in certain circumstances. But yeah, I can't replicate that. And I've not had ever any issues with the readers. I think if you saw that, people would post in comments, I'm not going to this link because it looks really spammy. And I've never seen that for SPF or all my books. And given the fact that we're advertising at fairly large volumes across both of those, I think we would have seen it by now. So my view is no reason to be too concerned at the moment.
Yeah, I thought I'd mention it though, because it's something people are seeing and it is worrying when you see it. Okay, we have a couple of patrons who are welcome to the Self-Publishing Show. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. We have, I think, Junior Pomerantz from MD, Maryland, I think. Junior Pomerantz, which is a heck of a name, from Maryland. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. We also have Laurie Urbaniak and Kendry Meeks. I don't know if there's any relation to the famous Brian Meeks, who pops up at conferences and teaches us all various things. But anyway, thank you very much indeed for joining us. If you go to patreon.com/self-publishing show, you too can be a part of this warm, friendly, embracing environment that we call the Self-Publishing Show. Now, our interviewee this week, Mark, we had her on a year or so ago, maybe a bit more than a year or so ago. A fascinating interview for me because I learned all about reverse harem, which I noticed is not something you've introduced to any of your books yet.
No, I haven't. I was going to say you live in one, but now you have a name to put to it. So congratulations. It's a good thing to learn.
There you go. It's good to have
what's
the
nomenclature correct. What's a reverse harem, James, for those who don't know? Remember, this is a family podcast. There are children, children listening.
It's not necessarily explicit. It can just be romantic. But the general concept is one female protagonist and multiple male protagonists. So historically, we may have seen in sort of COD Arabian type 1950s films, God, the other way around.
Here we go.
Seen on male... A male with his harem, which is, I think, where the word comes from. And of course, there was... that big
that's
family? Harem. I think it's an Arabic name.
Oh, I see. You're talking about etymology now. Okay, yes, possibly. I don't know. I don't speak Arabic.
What's that noise? Strange noise. Anyway, was it Gary Sinise drama show a few years ago about a Utah Mormon family that was...
Oh,
that traditional harem, big family or something like that. Okay, it was a good show, actually. But anyway, that's the kind of traditional one. I suppose that's been turned on its head in this particular subgenre of romantic fiction. It feels to me quite anime-ish in the characterizations, but I'm not sure if that's strictly true. But it was one of those little niche genres that just exploded, and Steph Green was at the center of that. She had a series really take off, and at the beginning of the interview, she recaps what happened during that. But she's somebody who doesn't stand still at all. She has developed a new series. She's gone into new genres. She's tried to take her audience with her. And she's also somebody who writes fast but needs a little bit of structure. So she's developing some tools that we can all use, particularly if you want to be a discovery writer, but you do need some sort of framework in which to operate to allow you to do a skeleton type sketch and then get on with the fun bit of writing. And she does all this, by the way, by being legally blind. She's an amazing individual. Steph over there in Auckland, about as far away you can get from here. So let's hear from Steph, and then Mark and I will be back for a chat.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Steph, welcome back to the Self-Publishing Show. Lovely to have you on again and talking about what's happened since we spoke last time, because you introduced me to the delights of reverse harem, which I've never forgotten last time.
Kia ora, James. It's great to be back. And yes, that's me. I was the reverse harem writer from a couple of years back. And yeah, it's life's been quite interesting in between now and then.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know. I've been reading the notes. And so we're going to go through some of that now. But let's talk about that episode for a start, because what you had done really is, like a prospector in the Texan dust, you had hit a rich, fertile spurt of oil with that series, and you had a real, I mean, not just a breakout success, a real success that year, didn't you?
I did, yes.
So just tell us about that and how it went.
Well, I guess I started writing Reverse Harem back in very early 2018. And I came to the genre as a reader first, or the trope as a reader first, and loved it. I was so addicted. But I sort of never thought, you know, I was a romance author, but I sort of never thought, I don't think I could write one of these. And then, of course, you know, the immediately when you think I could never write that, an idea comes to you. Like, that's the way it works. And so, yeah, so I had this idea and I wrote a series and that did really, really well. And I was able to quit my job. And then I wrote another series, which also did quite well. And then I sort of started noticing that people on the reverse harem forums and the Facebook groups were starting to talk about these things called bully romances, yeah. And they were asking, these readers were asking, you know, has anyone got any more bully romances? And they kind of would post the books that they were talking about. And I'd read these books and they were set in high schools and they were sort of enemies to lovers romances, but kind of on steroids. Like, they weren't just enemies in the beginning, you know, the guys that eventually became the heroes were like outright bullies to the heroines. And they were so addictive. And I sort of realized, I'm like, oh gosh, this is going to be big. And I don't know why I knew that, but I just knew. I was like, this is going to be big. And there were only a few of these books out at the time. And I thought, gosh, well, you know, maybe I could do one. And I was sort of hunting around for this idea, hunting around for the spark that would kind of, you know, give me the story. And then the spark came in the shower, which is where all the best ideas happen.
Of course.
And it was, what if I combined this bully romance trope, you know, this bully romance thing, which always has to happen in high school or college, with, you know, one of my favorite sort of science fiction horror universes, H.P. Lovecraft's universe, you know, the Cthulhu mythos. So what if I wrote a Cthulhu mythos book as a bully romance? And it seems so ridiculous that could ever be successful. I put the book up for pre-order. I wrote a blurb. I put the pre-order up. I had no book. I had no professional cover. I just made myself a crappy cover in Canva. And I got 935, I think, pre-orders.
Wow.
On that book in like 3 weeks. It was crazy.
That's so brave. Putting that up without the book being written. I mean, you're confident.
I figured, you know, worst case scenario, you know, I put this thing up and it doesn't get any pre-orders and I just don't have to write it, you know. But I was getting, like 25 pre-orders a day. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is wow. So I wrote this book in 3 weeks, which is the fastest I've ever written a book. And it just poured out of me. It was just so much fun. And there was a lot of kind of, you know, because I was bullied in high school because of my eyesight. So there was a lot of like personal things in there as well. You know, kind of situations that I'd been through and I kind of revamped them. And what was quite fun about it was being able to, you know, you kind of always walk away from situations where, and you think, gosh, I wish I'd done that. Mm. I wish I'd said this epic comeback and just shut the whole thing down, and you never do, and instead you cry or something. And so in the book, I got to make my heroine do all the stuff that I was too afraid to do. And so it was really cool. And then the book came out and it hit the top 20, it was 22 on the Amazon store release day. And it was incredible. No advertising beyond just putting it in the Reverse Harem Facebook groups. Nothing. And that blew my mind. And then I very quickly, I put out book two, book three, book four, and they all did epically well. And that was my 2019. It was amazing.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions about this. First of all, it intrigues me how these subgenres work, because it's not just a case. I mean, the Bully Boys, you said, it's a bit of a classic thing, the bad boy romance. In fact, you know, going back to Jane Austen and Mr. Darcy, sort of badly treating that as part of the one romantic trope. But these modern subgenres, and reverse harem was one, this Bully Boy is another, they have very particular settings that make them work. And is this is driven by readers, or do one or two, presumably one or two writers start this and start the sort of high school setting, the bully boy trope here, and that creates this little burst of subgenre?
I mean, it's kind of a little bit of both. You know, high school settings, college settings, new adult romance, like hyper angsty romance has been popular for a very long time. And I don't know what made the bully thing sort of suddenly take off in 2019, but it was probably part of the zeitgeist of the moment or something, but it was very much reader driven. Like, authors weren't calling their books bully romances. That was what readers were calling them.
Right.
And there were sort of three or five books that were out before mine. And then there were older books, and you know, readers would say, oh, if you want a bully romance, there's this book from, you know, 2014, or this book from 2000s, you know, and that kind of fits fits the trope, even though the authors back then had never called them that. And so it was absolutely fascinating for me as an author to kind of, this is the first time I'd ever sort of really seen a trend like blossom before me. It was pretty cool.
So it went well. And how many did you write in the series?
I wrote four in total.
Okay. And did each one sell well?
Yep. Each one was pretty incredible. It was really fun.
And this was last year?
Yeah, the final one, the fourth book, came out, I think, about the 7th of January this year.
Okay, and what happens to these subgenres? Do they burn out as quickly as they blew up?
I mean, bully is still very much very big. You know, there's a lot of, there's an author released a bully book, and it was last week, and I think it was number 7 in the store or something like that. They're still big, big, big. But they've definitely sort of moved outside. You know, a lot of them are reverse harem, and of course reverse harem is still very popular at the moment. But again, like all trends, you know, eventually what happens is lots and lots of authors jump on the trend, which is exactly what you want to do. And there becomes a tipping point where there's more writers writing in that trend than there are readers who want to read it. And so, you know, it's harder as an author who's writing in a trend to get attention on your books. And I'm not sure if bully's quite there yet as a trend, but I think it's definitely getting closer.
Okay. This really is like prospecting, isn't it? You're in the mountains.
Yeah.
I mean, I use the oil digging analogy, but it's a bit like the gold prospectors, and you've got to be on your own finding a seam rather than joining a group later when everybody's found it in the scraps. Fascinating. I mean, this is the cutting edge of the commercial world of writing and publishing at the moment.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, chasing trends is not sort of a really like clever business plan. But I think, you know, so, you know, I got lucky because I got in right at the beginning of a trend. And so my book was often, you know, it's often some of the books that people talk about when they talk about bully romance, which is pretty cool. You know, so a large part of that was luck. But also, you know, I saw the trend coming because I was super involved in the reader groups, as a reader, as an author, and because I was watching, you know, I was watching Amazon, I was watching which books do well and, you know, why they did well, and listening to readers and, you know, what they were really excited about. And so and also because I was able to write fast, I was able to get that book out really, really quickly. And so there's skills involved that we can all learn and all improve on. And so, you know, one day when you see a trend emerging, you can jump on it really quickly.
Yeah, I guess it dovetails with, in your case, with your own passions, which is important. And the bully, I just explore this particular subgenre before we move on a bit. This bully boy, you say it's like Bad Boy on steroids, where he genuinely is a bully. And that seems to be quite a difficult transition to make. I mean, you almost talked about the kind of the superhero when you talked about, you know, when you were bullied, which is always distressing to hear about. Hate to hear about that, Steph, but, you know, part of your life, and you wished afterwards, like we all do, after the moment, thinking what you could have said and done. And it seems to me that's what the superhero films kind of do for us. The Peter Parker gets his amazing powers and suddenly can make mincemeat of those people who were bullying him before. But in those scenarios, the bullies don't really prosper, do they? They don't go on a redemption journey. And the bad boy is one thing, being a bit rough around the edges, but taking a full-on bully through to presumably the heroic status at the end of the book, that seems quite a challenge.
It was really, really interesting. And it's also been interesting to see how, you know, the different ways that other authors have tackled this. And for me, it was actually really important for me to kind of understand, like, you know, personally, why I was bullied. And kind of honestly, writing the books made me really realize that the people that hurt me and that hurt others that I know were themselves hurting. And I think that's really the key, is that, you know, people often manifest outwardly the way they feel inwardly. And the redemption arc of the bully in the books is a huge part of what readers love about it. You know, they want to see, you know, this bad boy still be a bad boy, because we love bad boys. But go through that redemption arc and heal and realize that they've been a horrible person, and maybe grovel a bit and maybe pay for it a bit, but also in the end become a hero. And, you know, I think that's a really wonderful thing to believe, that, you know, even people who do horrible things can, you know, can themselves become heroes.
Yeah. Empathy, I've always said, is the key to life, even if it's sometimes a difficult thing to do when somebody's crossed you or hurt you. But there you go. So I can see that. That's really nicely explained. So you found this seam of gold. You makes it sound like you're a cynical gold digger, but you actually were reveling in doing something you loved. And there was, as I say, a dovetailing of passions there. And then you said, as it became more difficult and more crowded space. And what happened after that then? What happened in the rest of 2020, apart from a global pandemic, which also happened?
Yeah. Yes, apart from a global pandemic. So I thought I would be super clever. And I thought, well, this bully series done really well for me, so I'm going to write another one. And I'm going to focus really hard on recreating the things that I did really well in my current, in my popular series. And I was going to, you know, cut all the stuff that I didn't think I did very well. So I planned out in great detail. I wrote a brand new series, a brand new bully series, and I launched it straight after the last book, and it completely flopped. Was a complete no-show.
Wow, that's amazing. Not just a slight disappointment, but a complete flop. Can you explain that?
A complete flop, yes. So, you know, it didn't break top 1,000 even on release day. I think I might have made about 5,000 in the first month off of this new book, but I probably spent 4,500 on ads. It was horrible. It was such a flop, and it was hard that first month, because this was basically right around when, you know, we here in New Zealand went into our lockdowns. And, you know, so I'm looking at this book and I'm getting worried about everything, and I'm thinking, what have I done wrong? I don't understand why, you know, I thought I did everything right. What have I done wrong? And then I was able to kind of sit back and look at this new book and suddenly start to realize just how wrong I'd got things. And it's hard to do, because it means admitting to yourself that you messed up a bit. I messed up a few things. I So my new series, which was called Mandalay Academy, I was trying to kind of capitalize on this thing that I do, which is where I bring like quite popular tropes from horror and gothic and the things that I really love into my romances. So I wrote this series, which was an academy, sort of another bully series set in a very prestigious small music academy. And it was basically a ghost story. It was a very classic sort of gothic romance, just with the bully thing over top of it. And I thought this would be a great thing. But the problem was that basically that bully romance is very much a contemporary romance trend. You know, that these are readers that want contemporary romances, they want bad boys, and it was starting to morph into sort of really dark romance, like really a lot of mafia kind of stuff and you know, gangs and crime families and things like that. And I'd written this book, which was sort of a ghost story, but it was not... But basically, it was not paranormal enough to appeal to paranormal readers and not contemporary enough to appeal to contemporary readers.
Okay.
And that's pretty much the crux of it.
Yeah, I suppose that is the flip side of these niche genres, is you do have to obey the rules.
Yep, and I buckled it up a bit.
There you go. Okay, well, we live and learn, and you're here talking about it. And one of the things I think that maybe as a result of that was turning your attention to some other non-fiction writing projects. Was this a lockdown plan of yours to try and... You're obviously a prolific writer and a fast writer, Steph, and you can turn these books around very quickly, and I say ballsy to the point of just putting it out there on pre-order before you'd even written it. And to get to that point, I think you've got you must have a pretty good system of outlining and writing.
yes and no. So it's really interesting to me because I am a complete pantser, and or what I like to call a gardener, which is, you know, we kind of plant a seed and we watch it grow, but we don't have any kind of plan going in really. Often when people talk about writing quite fast, so I publish sort of about 8 to 10 books a year. And often when people talk about writing quite fast, they talk about, you know, oh, you have to have a plan, you have to have an outline, it really helps you write faster. And I'm just like, it just grosses me out. No outlines. If I outline a book or anything like that, I would not write the book because I would be so bored. I would know what happens and blah, no.
Not for you.
Not for me. And so often when people are trying to, you know, when writers are trying to learn to write faster, they're, you know, as gardeners or pantsers, you know, we're often trying to fit ourselves into this outlining books. And I realized this year I taught a little writing class online for Alessandra Torre for her writing students. And I was talking about the way that I write books, and she was, what? Why do you write? You know, I've never heard of anyone writing like that. That's so interesting. And you always just sort of assumed everyone writes the way you write. And I was like, I didn't realize this was different. And so I thought, you know, maybe other people, especially other gardeners or other pantsers, could, you know, learn a little bit from what, you know, the way I work and what I was doing. So I started a little side project, which is a website for writers called Rage Against the Manuscript. And I've got a little podcast, and I've got articles up there and some writing courses. And the main course that I sell is a little cheap-ass $49 course about my gardening writing process called Writing the Skeleton Draft. And so a skeleton draft is what I do is for a typical length book, 70,000, 90,000, 100,000 words, I start off with a 10 to 20,000 word draft, which I write super quickly in about 3 days. And the skeleton draft is It's super rough. It's largely just like dialogue and action, and it's dividing the book into the chapters. So I put chapter one at the top, and I just start writing, you know, what I've got in my head for that chapter, and I end it on a cliffhanger, and then I go to the next chapter. And some of the chapters, you know, the chapters at the beginning of the book are often quite well sort of fleshed out, and then sort of towards the middle of the book, there might just be two lines, there might just be like insert sex scene here. That kind of thing. And I do that over in like a mad rush over 2 or 3 days. And then at the end, I've got this basically, it's basically an outline of a novel, except I've actually got 10 or 20,000 words of my actual novel written already. And then I go back to the beginning and I go over the novel again, and I kind of flesh it out, and I solve all the problems that I've made for myself, and I end up with about a 50,000 word draft. And then I do a third pass and usually a fourth pass, and that gives me a final draft of between 70,000, 95,000 words.
Well, that really is an interesting way of doing it. You start off with a really perfunctory description of the story, but written, I mean, tell me what that 10 to 20,000 word draft looks like.
So it looks, usually it's a lot of dialogue, because what I'm doing in this draft is basically getting to know the character. So for example, I've got the series, the reverse harem series. It's called the Nevermore Bookshop series. And it's basically a murder mystery, like a traditional Midsummer Murders kind of murder mystery, except that it is the main character and her harem are all famous literary characters. So it's got like Heathcliff in it. It's got James Moriarty from Sherlock Holmes, and it's got Quoth the Raven from Edgar Allan Poe's like a shapeshifter. So anyway, so every book they have to solve a murder mystery. And so, you know, so I know, and this is part of my method. I call this set pieces. You know that in a murder mystery, there's certain set pieces that have to happen in the story. So you have to find, you know, the heroine has to find the murder victim. Well, you know, otherwise you can't have the murder mystery. So very early on in the book, she has to find the murder victim. So I know that that's one scene that I have to write. So immediately in my head, I start going, okay, well, what's that scene look like? So I just basically do type away probably 800 words of maybe a 2,000 word scene. And it's just super rough. It's just, you know, it's just stumbling into the shop and finding the first murder victim on the floor. And then I'm like, oh, that's a great ending of the chapter. You know, there's a knife sticking out of her back. That's a perfect ending for a chapter. And I just push return, go to the next chapter. And then I keep writing, and it's rough. Often I end paragraphs halfway through a sentence, cause I'm just trying to get the next bit done. Yeah, it's mainly dialogue and action. There's not much description. I forget to describe what characters look like. It probably doesn't have, it's got sort of a lot of emotion in it, because that, you know, it's that sort of internal arc of the characters that I'm really focusing on in this draft, just really getting to know them and making sure they have a story.
You hated the idea of outlining, but this is a way of getting around that and allowing you to still be, like, should we call it a discovery writer? It's a slightly more polite term than pantser. Allowing you to be, yes, a discovery writer whilst cheekily outlining.
Exactly. It's basically the best of both worlds, because I'm writing the book. So it feels to me, it feels exactly like I, you know, what I love, which is, yeah, discovering it as I go along, and going, oh, what's the next set piece that I need to have? You know, there needs to be a red herring, so I've got to figure that out and go do that. But because I'm doing it really, really fast, I'm getting all my ideas down super fast. And then I get to look at it at the end and go, oh, look, I have just written 20,000 words in 3 days. And I now know everything that's going to happen in my novel. And I can now go back to the beginning again with all the stuff that I now know having got to the end and make it pretty. And that is also really fun.
And you don't mind the next bits then, bearing in mind your aversion to the of writing when you know what's happening. You're okay with going over that draft and expanding it by another big, by tripling it probably, and then a bit more at the end.
Yeah, I find it really fun. And I guess I don't quite know why my brain thinks it's different, but it does. And to me, it just feels like the really fun part of editing, where you kind of, you know, the finish, the final bit of my skeleton draft, it's terrible. Like, it's embarrassing if I had to show anyone that. And in my course, the final module was actually me going through a skeleton draft of an old book, and it was mortifying filming it because I was like, I don't want to show anyone this horrible mess. But then, you know, being able to take like three paragraphs of basically rubbish with like gaps in them and then knowing, just having the faith that you're a good enough writer that by the end of this, that those three paragraphs and all the other paragraphs are just going to sing. They're just going to be amazing. And yeah, every time I look at a skeleton draft versus the final version, like I can see the magic that was hidden in the skeleton draft, and it's really cool.
Mm. And the advantage of this, do you think, is speed, or is it the quality of the manuscript you get at the end?
For me, it's both. It's probably primarily speed, because the biggest problem that us discovery writers, us gardeners face is that we get stuck because we are writing like a chapter at a time, and we don't know what's going to happen next. So we often get to the middle of a chapter and we're like, oh crap, I don't know what's going to happen, how am I going to do it? And so my whole system, the skeleton draft, the set pieces, something I have called Chekhov's arsenal, it's all designed to kind of help you move forward in the manuscript. And then you're able to get that really quickly and get past those issues that we have, and then, yeah, just get to that while having fun at the same time.
Is this your system now? Is this what you use all the time? This is.
Yep. I have been using it basically since I started, but I sort of didn't realize, I didn't have a name for it. I didn't realize this was kind of not what everyone did. And yeah, now I know that this is what I do. And actually writing the course kind of helped me like solidify it. Like, oh, that's why I do that, and that's why that works. And so now I'm like, oh well, I know what works, so you know, gonna do it.
And since you've done the course, you've been in obviously liaising with people who are following the method now. Who do you think this suits? I mean, everyone has different ways and different. I mean, you get five writers in a room, you'll find seven different ways of writing a book immediately when you ask them. It's not going to suit everyone, I guess.
No, and it's definitely, if you are someone who loves like really, you know, really intense outlines, you will hate the system. It will just be awful for you. It's definitely a system for fellow pantsers, or fellow discovery writers. And you know, not every discovery writer will like the system, but. You know, I found for me, and certainly for a number of people that have taken my little course, that it's basically, you know, I get emails all the time from people going, oh my gosh, this has solved all the problems. You know, one lady the other day said, I've spent the last 5 years trying different systems, trying to force myself to outline books so that I could write faster, and it's had the exact opposite effect. And I used your skeleton draft, and I wrote my first draft in 3 days, and I feel like I finally got it, and that's so cool.
It's funny you say you really didn't like writing when you knew where it was going to go, if you properly did a detailed outline. There are lots of people writing like that, particularly I think in romance for some reason. Maybe it's something to do with that. That's the kind of real life thing about romance, isn't it? You're not sure which way it's going to go. Maybe it's replicating that. Whereas I think back to the first draft of my first book, which was a long, torturous thing, and I actually didn't enjoy not knowing whether this story was working, whether it was going to go places. And I absolutely loved rewriting it, knowing that I'd done that kind of hard bit And I don't mind rewriting an entire book. I'm rewriting it for the fifth time now. I think that's how it works for me. And in fact, I think in the old days, probably I'm a bit of an old-fashioned guy, in the old days, I think novelists did often rewrite two or three times before they submitted to the editor, didn't they? So there's a bit of the advantage of that combined with the more modern approach of getting it done.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, my first series, I must have rewritten those books 10 times. Like, you know, my first book, it took me 5 years to write, and I must have rewritten it so many times during that time. But, you know, I certainly think part of the system and, you know, part of writing in general is, you know, you get better at it the more you do it. And I definitely at a stage in my career now where, like, I mean, to a certain extent, we all know how our books are going to end anyway. I mean, and I talk about this a lot in the course, like, we don't know the details. For a romance novel, you know, sometimes you used to look towards the end of a book and it's just all darkness and dragons. Like, I can't see it. But when you think about it, you know, with a romance novel, we know how it's going to end. It's going to end on a happily ever after. We just have to get the how.
Yeah. Do you ever write ahead? Do you ever do that thing where I'm sort of tempted to do that. My second book now drafting is, because I got a little bit stuck in the middle, is to write the last third because I know exactly how that's going to go. Is that helpful?
Yes, sometimes I do that. Not every book. You know, every book's a bit different. But sometimes if I feel a bit stuck, I'll go out of order and I'll just skip ahead to a scene that I know absolutely has to happen, a set piece like I was kind of talking about. And I just write those. And, you know, early on, I think in novels, I'm really focused on just getting as many words down as possible. And then, you know, because I I've written 40 plus novels now, and I know that I can fix it. I can fix it in post-production. That's what I always tell myself.
Fix it in post. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's how, when I worked in video production, that was our cry about everything. And of course, we all knew the reality was it couldn't fix many of those things in post. Anyway, that's brilliant. Really interesting to hear. And we'll just give it another plug again. So the course is called, Rage Against the Manuscript. In fact, if you just type that into Google, it comes up in top spots. It's a good name.
Yes, I was quite proud of that.
Excellent. And people can. And how's it gone? How's it gone since you've done the course?
Oh, it's gone so well. You know, I was a bit worried because, you know, the Rage Against the Manuscript, the whole website and everything, it's basically two books that I didn't write this year because I, you know, worked on that website. But I think this is still, even though it's coronavirus year and it's crazy, it's still been my second most successful year ever as an indie author. So, you know, it hasn't been too bad.
And let me ask you a little bit about your setup now. So we talked about writing quite a lot. And what you mentioned earlier, spending quite a lot on ads, which didn't work for that second series this year. But generally speaking, are you somebody running paid ads every day?
I was running a lot of ads at the beginning of the year. I actually hired someone to do it, and basically COVID happened and my household income dropped and I could no longer afford it, so I cut it and I haven't picked it up again. I've spent the year teaching myself how to do AMS ads, and I've got AMS ads to a point where they're starting to work a little bit, and I don't spend very much. I spend maybe $300 a month, and I don't run currently. I do not run I do not run Facebook ads on fiction, but I do run about $10 a day worth of ads to my nonfiction, the Rage Against the Manuscript website.
Okay. So where do your sales come from generally if it's not the paid ads drivenness?
I run a lot, so basically organic, sort of the reverse harem Facebook groups. I run my newsletter pretty hard. So, you know, I've got a big backlist and I send a newsletter once a week, and so I'm always promoting stuff from my backlist into my newsletter, and also I run a lot of like Kindle countdown deals, and sometimes I use the newsletter ads to promote them, and sometimes I don't. I just send them to my newsletter or put them in the Facebook groups, and that's kind of it. But yeah.
Great. Well, we talked about this method, Steph, and I think you did say that you might be able to put together maybe a one-pager just to help people and give them a taster of how to do the skeleton draft. Is that something we can offer out?
It absolutely is. I have already done it. I will send it to you presently.
Excellent. Okay, well, we'll send that. We'll put that on the URL, selfpublishingformula.com/draft, D-R-A-F-T. It's just a name. And I must remember to make a note of that so that everybody else in the vast team that goes together putting this podcast out also know about it. So I just do make stuff up and don't tell people sometimes. /draft. It's definitely one I'm going to be reading. I'm really interested in developing the way that I come up with drafts. So I move on to book two. Makes me feel like I'm still haven't published book one as we're recording this, but I am writing a second book, which makes me feel like I might actually be starting to understand how this whole thing works. And I'm intrigued by these methods. In fact, I think when we do these interviews, we talk about marketing and ads and this, that, and the other, but really it's how we all write books, I think, is the most interesting topic that comes up.
I think I agree, actually. I love hearing about different people's marketing techniques and things, but, you know, it all starts with the book, you know, it all comes back to the book. And so, you know, craft and just, you know, the methods we use, it's so, you know, there's always something new to learn or something new to try.
Yeah. And I think you're a great example of knowing your genre. I mean, you're a passionate reader, I can tell, in those areas. And so there's one of the reasons why you're so quick to the those breakout subgenres.
I think so. Yeah. And, you know, I read quite widely, and my romance pen name is kind of a testament to that. Like, it's, you know, but basically I write gothic romance because that's what, you know, I love the gothic, anything the gothic. Look at my shirt, like, obviously. I'm obsessed with it. And, you know, gothic romance is not a genre you can really sell. So I kind of disguise it as other things, which has been working really, really well for me. 2021 will be interesting because I'm actually starting a secret moonshot project, which is in psychological thrillers, which I'm quite excited about.
And when you say moonshot?
I mean, it's basically a shot at the moon. It's, you know, so, you know, something that is a big risk.
Okay.
Yeah, this is completely out of my you know, usual wheelhouse, and I might be trying to pitch it to TradPub. I haven't decided yet.
Okay, that sounds interesting. And finally, Steph, we should mention that you are registered blind. Just tell us a little bit about how the day-to-day works for you then. Presumably dictation plays a big part in your writing.
Nope.
Ah, that's surprising.
No, I mean, that is really common for writers who are blind or legally blind, but not for me. So I am, I'm legally blind. I have an eye condition where I don't have any cone cells in my eyes. You're supposed to have about 3 million and I've got none. And so I don't see any colour. And I'm extremely light sensitive, and I have a lot of trouble, like, my eyes kind of wobble a bit, and that's why I squint, which is why they're always closed. And I can't see to drive. I can't see, like, you know, much in front of my face. But I have a giant screen, which is set up so that it sits like an inch from my face, and, you know, my nose kind of scrapes against it sometimes. And I, you know, use a setting on the computer that inverts the colors, so I have a black background with white type, which helps with the glare, and big but giant print, and my little writing library is like a dark cave with the windows shut, and it's literally a writing cave, and it's wonderful. And basically I don't deal with anything because I can't see in color at all, so I don't deal with anything to do with color. So I do sometimes make my own graphics, like graphics for Facebook and stuff, but I do it in Canva, where there's kind of like lots of preset templates, and I just don't deviate from the templates. And every time I get a new cover from a cover designer, I have to run it past all my friends because I can't tell what the colors are.
That's a condition you've had your whole life.
Yep, it's genetic. It is, it's very, very rare. It's called achromatopsia. It's very rare. And it's genetic, and it won't get any better, won't get any worse. But as of right now, there's no cure. However, some scientists in Israel have just cured a flock of sheep with the condition. Wow. Although how they knew that the sheep couldn't see in colour is... Wow.
But they probably don't want to know, but I imagine they probably gave them that in the first place. But anyway, that's exciting news for you. The colour thing's fascinating, isn't it? So if you've not known colour your whole life, yet you normally in writing, not just choices about covers, but in description, in writing, you the idea of colour, even if it's not something you've personally experienced.
Yeah, you kind of get the concept. And actually, it's really interesting because, my whole life I've always had, my mum or friends or, now my husband. And, I often ask about colours, my husband will say, oh, there's a really beautiful sunset tonight. And then he sort of just automatically does this now. He goes, oh, it's like a streak of like deep purple and then a streak of, vibrant orange. And you kind of... the descriptions that people give, you kind of get an idea. Grass, like fresh grass is like this lush green color, and it kind of feels like lush when when you touch it. And, things often sort of smell the way people describe the colors. And so, all that kind of goes up here. And then, when I go to write descriptions about things in the books, it comes out again. But I do, people often say in reviews, one thing that I do a lot is I sort of forget to describe people, like what they look like, because I don't, that's not how I articulate the world. So I sometimes, I have these like really hot heroes, but I'll completely sort of forget to really describe them. But people always have like very vivid descriptions of their voices and the way they smell.
Right. That's interesting, that your own sort of references. But I imagine in romance, describing the hot hero in some detail is one of those things, again, part of the rules.
It's kind of important. Yeah. Yes. So I've got very good editors who always remind me, hey, look, you sort of haven't told people what this guy looks like.
Yeah. That's not a bad job, is it, having to describe a hot hero? If that's the worst thing that comes back from your editor. Steph, it's an absolute joy to talk to you. Quite inspiring in so many ways. And not least your sort of discovery this year of, I do love talking to you about the subgenres and understanding how those tropes ebb and flow and hearing even from you when you get it wrong and understanding why that didn't work in that case. And there are, I think, a lot of people who write in this area and are... it sounds awful to say chasing these subgenres, but it's a fun thing to do. It's what readers do. They kind of chase these subgenres and find themselves going down, one series and then moving on to something else. And that's actually a fun world to be in, I think.
It really is. And, like I said, it's probably not the best, as like a long-term career strategy, chasing trends is not the, the best strategy to choose. But, as long as you're writing books that you love and you're really passionate about, write the books that you want. And, eventually if you pay attention and if you come to the world as a reader, eventually you'll find yourself right at the beginning of a trend. And it's really great to be able to have the skills to capitalize on that. None of us are going to say no to that.
No. Steph, thank you so much indeed for coming on board. We will again talk about the giveaway, selfpublishingformula.com/draft, if you want to start getting your teeth into that method. And I think it's something I'm definitely going to have a little play with because it sounds really, really interesting. Steph, thank you.
Cheers, James. Thank you.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
There you go, Steph Green. Lovely to catch up with her. Prolific writer. Love those little subgenres. It does feel to me Australia and New Zealand does produce more of that type of books. I speak to those authors that have that kind of... It feels to me like Japanese anime influenced, although I don't think Steph agreed with that when I said it. But you know, some of the characterizations. We used to sit and watch that anime stuff, didn't we, at BBFC? It was a bit of an iron, but it has its own feel. It's a slightly, I don't know how to describe it really. It's its own thing. Nothing else quite feels like it.
I don't know how to describe it either. I don't really know where you're going. Well, I suppose the only thing I would say is, I think Australia is influenced, isn't it, by Japanese culture a little bit. But I wouldn't, I'm not sure. We have lots of Aussies who listen to the show, so maybe they can help in the, you know, in the comments of the YouTube video. If there's anything that you think is interesting on that, they should definitely leave us a comment. And, you know, we can learn, teach James about Australian culture. Yeah.
It stands to reason that Australia and New Zealand are more influenced by Asian culture than we are here. Just geographically is more likely to be the case. But feels to me that slips over into literature. Right. Good. Well, lovely to catch up with Steph. We'll certainly speak to her again over the next few years, however long this whole thing goes on. Goes on forever, doesn't it, this podcast? Episode, we're going to get to 1,000.
Apparently, yes. We're a quarter of the way there. We'll stop at 1,000.
Yeah. Don't say that. We're going to get to 1,000. Anyway, it's lovely to catch up with Steph. Thank you very much indeed for listening this week. Mark, I think that's what we've got to say on the self-publishing show this week.
I believe so. Yes, I have nothing to add.
Good. Well, we've got lots of interviews on the cupboard waiting to come out in 2021. On the cupboard, in the cupboard, probably the best place to put it. And very exciting. And we might even have two published authors presenting this show at some point in the not too distant future.
Are you being replaced?
Yes, I am. Yeah. I'm bringing in Tom Ashford.
Fair enough. The quality will go up accordingly.
Of course it will. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much indeed. All that remains for me to say is it's a goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.